Hello and welcome to today's Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today, as he is the first Thursday of every month, is Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And if I get the Facebook page up here soon enough, go ahead and go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and you'll see a promo for today's program and just post your comments or questions there. And we'll be looking there as well. Dan, thanks for coming in.
I hope there's individuals that have garden questions yet in our listening audience that can come back to us and we can try to solve some issues that may have arisen over the course of the year. And we'll talk about some of those things that we have seen and questions that people have sent me that, cause some anxiety when it comes to their garden. And we don't want garden anxiety. We want, healthy, productive gardens that, make us feel good. Boy, my garden is, I've been eating so well.
It's been great. A really good growing year, I think.
I think it has.
Not too hot.
Yeah.
A little wet in May, but,
But, we're beyond that. That wet weather in May kind of slowed things up a little bit. If you planted in early May or late April, some of those crops tended to slow up a bit in May when it was so wet and on the cool side. And then we kind of flipped the disc over and we came right into hot and dry weather in June, and then it's from July on, I think it's actually been quite a pleasant summer. And
did we even get over 98 in Cache Valley?
I don't believe
St. George has hardly been into the hundreds very much.
I don't believe we have. I know I kind of gauge things by my electric bill and whether the air conditioner runs, and it hasn't run very much. The last couple nights have been kind of warm, but, that's, not uncommon for early September from what I understand. So,
well, let's take a look at some of the ripening issues. We did a little bit of this last month, but let's look at winter squash right now. How do you tell when your squash is ready to pick?
Well, there's a couple of simple ways to do it. Some people like to just go by color. If you've got a green-fruited type of winter squash, it's hard to tell that. Usually, fruits that look shiny tend to be immature. So a lot of our squashes, when we're out there kind of rummaging around in the garden, we think that they're ready when they kind of stop growing, but they really aren't. That's only part one of the growth process. The second part is to get size, and then after that, you get the flavors and the sugars, and you finish the flesh off so that it tastes like you would expect it. So young fruits that are not performing up to our expectation, young fruits will have that really shiny look to them. And as they mature, they start to mellow in color. They get a little bit more dull in appearance. And so that's an indicator that we're achieving maturity. But then the next thing that you should do is, use the scratch test, I call it. Take your fingernail or some sharp object, and if you can gouge into the skin with your fingernail or with a knife or something like that, then that rind is still immature and the flesh within it is going to still be immature. So I use the scratch test as a way to tell when banana squashes or butternuts or acorns or Hubbards are ready to go. And each of them have kind of a different color, so color doesn't help you much. It's kind of like our old adage about watermelon. How do you tell when they're ready? You need to really have a few indicators, and the easiest indicator on the squashes is scratching them. And if you can peel off a little bit of that skin, you need to wait a while. And I think a lot of the crop is early, though I did have some emails from different gardeners around the state and some of our extension educators around the state that have said people seem to think that their crops are kind of late this year. And we can discuss that a little bit later. And so, certainly, usually squash maturity starts in early September. It will not harm the plant in any way or the fruit in any way to leave it out in the garden and just let it ripen on the vine. In fact, it tends to build up more sugars that way and do those kinds of things. And then, as we've always said, that ideally it's best to harvest them before we have a really hard, hard freeze on them. So if the temperature is going to get down to freezing, really we should either cover them if they're still somewhat immature, or we should, get them out of the field and under some protection so that that tissue doesn't get damaged by the cold, because that's where a spot will happen. That's where a disease organism will start to grow on it. One of the secondary pathogens that are flying around all over the place, they settle on those spots and cause the fruit to ripe, be rotting in storage. And we really want to have some of those squashes hold through until January, February, maybe even longer than that.
So with the squash, if you use your fingernail to scrape along the top, so you're just using the back of your thumb and you just gently do it?
Yeah, just put some pressure on it, and you know you're going to pick up a little bit of it.
Just score it a little bit.
Yeah, if you pull an inch of the skin and you see some of the tissue flecking off onto your fingernail, that's an indicator that the rind isn't hardened. If the rind's not hardened, then the flesh isn't mature yet, and the flavors aren't going to be as sweet as we would like them. So just wait some more and let them ripen on the vine. They don't after ripen. That's the interesting thing about squashes. So they're not like a tomato that starts to color. You can pick it off the vine and it will color completely, but it doesn't have the flavor profiles. Mm-hmm. It needs to be on the plant in order to get the full flavor profile. And so therefore we just would say wait a week, wait 2 weeks or whatever, kind of watch the weather. And as I said, if we want to store them for a long period of time, we really don't want them to be frosted in any way. Even that chilling will damage the tissue enough so that you'll get some effects of it later on in storage. And it may take some weeks or months maybe for those spots to coalesce and grow and start to deteriorate. So therefore, that cold is the bad thing for many of our warm season crops.
And what about the storage itself? If you've picked it off the vine, does it need to be set in a warm place to cure, or can you immediately put it in? Because it doesn't go into a cold place ever.
Well, really, ideally, we would like to put it in a fairly warm environment after it's harvested for about a week or 10 days. What that does is seals the wounds that are on it. There are some changes in the tissue of remobilization of sugars and those types of things to get the final flavor profiles in place and condition it. And then what we normally would say for long-term storage, most of our winter squashes we want to store somewhere around 50 to 55 degrees.
And that's warmer than a lot of basements.
That's a lot warmer than most basements. We have the tendency to want to stick them into that cold fruit room that we have in many of our basements here in the state. That's so cold, it's actually got a porthole to the outside where cold air can get in. That's great for storing apples and pears, but it's terrible for storing squashes. And so I tend to stick mine off close to, you know, where my furnace is, that section within the basement. And, I mean, I think we harvested squash late September here last year, and I had some bananas and some butternuts that I had until almost the end of March by storing them in a much warmer area, and had, you know, minimal rotting that occurred because I don't stick them into I have a coal room where they used to have an old coal chute, mm-hmm. and that kind of is a really cold section. And that's where I stick my apples when I buy a bushel of apples, and I store some of those kinds of fruits in that section of the basement rather than elsewhere, just simply because apples like it cold and pears like it cold, but squashes like it warm. Onions like it cold, so I store my onions in there as well, or I store my onions in my garage, which is very close to the freezing point. It doesn't freeze, but it's very cold in my garage. And then I can keep onions all the way until almost May before most of them are starting to sprout or starting to soften to the point where they're not really that usable anymore.
But potatoes don't like the cold. They want the little bit warmer.
Well, just, yeah, because one of the things that happens with potatoes when we store those, they should be stored warm initially, because what the warmth helps does, but in the dark, warm and dark, is it helps set the skin on them. So when you're digging them, you often have a little bit of bruising or a little bit of brushing. You kind of, the skin is soft. It's not really set on them. So commercially, what they do is when they bring them out of the field and store them, they put them into storage, and that's actually, they warm up their storage facility for about a week and keep them at a higher temperature. That sets the skin on them.
Like 60?
Yeah, about 60 is a good place. And then they move them into cold storage, where the temperature is about 35 to 40 degrees.
Oh,
now,
okay.
There's a danger in storing them at 35 to 40 degrees, because what happens is potatoes are mostly starch, and some of those starches under cold conditions convert to sugars. And because so many of our stored potatoes aren't being used for fresh purposes but are going into the potato chip industry or into the French fry industry, and particularly with potato chips, is we want that chip to be fried, but we don't want it to be brown in color. And sugars caramelize, and that's where you get that brown color from. And so what they'll do, for particularly for those, in order to store them for a longer period of time, they actually store them cold, but then they slowly heat them up before they go back into the chipping plant to make potato chips or French fries, because they want them to be kind of brownish on the outside, and they can get that from the coatings that they put on them, but they want the inside to be white, and they don't want it to be brown all the way through. Or with a potato chip, we know we would like it to be light colored but crispy, and you need more starch for that to happen. So they slowly cool the potato down. It stores very well at very low temperatures. It doesn't sprout. It doesn't really rot or anything like that, because it's too cold for those organisms. But then they slowly warm them back up, and then those sugars convert back into starches. And it's the starches that don't brown, but sugars brown. And so that's one of the problems that we have when we store them in the refrigerator or we store them in our cold room, and then we mash them or something, and they say, well, they tasted really sweet, because what we've got is too much sugar in them.
So how do we do that, since we don't usually have an easy way to slowly warm and slowly
cool them down? Well, you know, that's kind of one of the dilemmas that we have, that most of us, I don't think, grow enough potatoes to store that many anyway. I mean, if you got them in your garden, you're probably digging them regularly because you like fresh potatoes and you like the flavors of those. And then if we are storing them, if we do go up to buy a 50-pound sack or something like that, we're going to store them in a cooler environment because we don't want them to sprout. But then we may not always be as happy with the flavors because we aren't really storing them at the right conditions. And if we store them too warm, they sprout. And if we store them cold, they convert to sugars, and then they have different flavor profiles. They don't have that floury or starchy kind of background flavor that we are familiar with when you have a baked potato. You have more of a kind of this sweet potato that some people don't. I think most people don't probably notice it, but if you know anything about potatoes, and you do, I notice it all the time. I can tell. So most of the ones that we buy in the store that you're getting on a regular basis have been warmed and have more of that starchy, floury background flavors and feel characteristics when we consume them, that it indicates to me that they're doing that kind of cooling and then warming again in order to get the product and keep the product well.
Well, we only have about 12 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to get in your question or comment, Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is in the studio today with the Zesty Garden, and you can reach us with your questions or comment, 1-800-826-1000. 1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment there at the top along with the information about today's program. So we did have a shy caller who did not want to go on the air, okay, but wants to know about harvesting onions.
Well, you know, it's that time of the year again, and ideally what we would do is we'd wait until about, if you have a patch of onions in your garden, usually we say onions are mature when about half of the crop's tops, the leaf part of the plant, has begun to fall over, and it's beginning to open up the canopy, and it's getting soft, and the neck is beginning to not be able to support the leaf growth that's up above the bulb. And so when about half of that occurs, you can go through and push the rest of them over. And then usually we would recommend that you would either lift them slightly, so you're breaking the roots a little bit so that the bulb starts to dry out and the tops start to dry out. And then take those tops and lay them over top of the bulbs that are there so that you get some shading from that, and let that crop finish itself off so that the tops become very dry. And then you have two options. You can just leave the tops on the plants and throw them in a bucket, or I have a bunch of old 20-gallon pots or plastic tubs that I bought big trees in. I just throw them in that and put them in my garage with the tops right on them and then leave them there. And they have enough air movement through that. The tops are dry already, and then use them as I need them. When I go out there, I just clip the tops off and bring the bulbs into the kitchen to use, and they just are stored in my garage. So that's a simple way to do it. The commercial industry pretty much does it the same way. They actually have a instrument that runs under the plants, loosens the soil, allows the soil to slowly dry out, allows those tops to start to senesce, and then once the tops are completely dry and yellow, and you feel them and they feel dry and crinkly, then you bring them into your storage location. And the best place to store your onions would be either in your garage where it's cool, but doesn't freeze, because we don't want to freeze them, or into your fruit cellar where it stays very cold throughout the winter. And then you should have onions that store all the way through into, you know, late March or early April easily.
Our next caller is Delmer from Roosevelt. Hi, Delmer. How can we help?
Hi. I just had a few comments to make. Squash is one of my favorite things to grow, and we like to see how long we can keep them. We still have about 10 left from last year.
Oh, my goodness. That's wonderful.
About 2 months ago, we had an English cheese squash from even the year before for it.
So what happened to the tissue? It gets a little bit grainy or so after a while, doesn't it?
They pretty well keep the flavor. We like to do a little hybridizing, and we keep anything that has extra good flavor or keeps extra long.
Yeah.
And then every year in the fall, we have a little game. We go out to the garden and write our names on things. You mentioned the skin when it's still little loose. We like to do like they do on the, which they shouldn't, on your aspen trees.
I know exactly what you're doing. Yep.
Draw pictures, and we have quite a game at it that way. So
it is kind of fun to do that. I know when we were children, we did the same type of thing. We would scratch our names into the fruits, and while the fruit was still on the green side, and kind of almost do like you say on a tree or something where you carve your initials into it. We kind of did that, or drew faces, and then they mature, and that tissue shows up as that, and then they came in and said, and we would say, oh, we're eating my brother Dirk's squash, or we're eating this squash, and it was just something that we did as well. And so that has to do, they were still immature and they needed a couple more weeks out in the garden. So yeah, great stuff.
Yeah, it has to be so that skin is a little bit soft yet.
That's right. You got any questions then?
Great.
Good. Thanks, Delbert.
Just comment. Hey, appreciate your program.
Okay, well, good.
Thanks, Delbert. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. So while we're on the Allium family. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about garlic and shallots.
Sure. You know, it's September in most of our cooler, colder areas of the state is a great time to start thinking about planting garlic. And normally we would either buy seed garlic or we can actually take cloves out of garlic plant of garlic that we grew last spring and or last fall and harvested in July and replant some of those cloves. We don't recommend that you do that too many years in a row because we do get some virus diseases and things like that that show up that really impact the productivity over the long term. So periodically it does pay to buy some new seed garlic, we would call that. Normally, like up here in northern Utah, we would start planting, you know, toward the end of September and into early October. And the reason we want to plant then is you actually want to plant to grow a little bit before it gets super cold. Because what happens is the clove needs a certain amount of chilling in order for the meristem to divide to produce all those cloves that we're going to get next year. And it can't do that in the middle of the winter. It's just too cold. The cellular activity, the metabolic activity that's in the cell is so slow that nothing is really happening. So if we don't plant early enough, we actually don't get enough division before that cold comes. And as it warms up in the spring, all we really are doing is filling up those that have divided in the fall. And so the later we plant, the smaller the clove tends to be.
So if you try to plant in the spring.
Yeah, you don't get enough chilling. So you get a few cloves that form, but it's really small. And unless you can get out in January, and sometimes if we plant in January, people have tried that experiment. They don't divide that much anyway because it's not doing anything because the ground is just too cold. So the trigger temperatures are about 45 to 55 degrees. And in the middle of the winter, we're way colder than 45 or 55 degrees. So get them in northern Utah, usually toward the end of September or into early October. And then if you're in the warmer areas of the state, Moab, St. George, and those areas, usually it's toward the end of October is when we would want to do that into November because their falls are a lot longer, they're warmer, and you're going to still get the chilling that you need, and you need a certain amount of growth. If you're interested in shallots and you've got some shallot bulbs that you want to replant, that would also be the same time that you would replant those. Now, if you're planting shallots from seed, which you can find bulbs of shallots that you can replant, or you can plant shallots from seeds, the seeds we would actually plant in the spring exactly at the same time we would plant onion seed, which would be sometime in early to mid-March if you're in northern Utah, early to mid-February if you were in southern Utah. So that they get some cold and divide as well, because shallots oftentimes have multiple bulbs to them as well. And if we're planting one of those offsets, we would call that. Some people shorten that word to sets, just like an onion set. But we won't plant that in the fall. We'll plant that in the spring, because if we get too much cold on the onion set, it actually flowers, and that's not something that we want. But shallots don't do that. So we can plant those in the fall, but it needs enough cold in order for it to divide as well. And so the shallots that are fall planted will have more offsets in them, whereas if we plant shallots in the spring, we tend to have more like an onion bulb because it doesn't get the chilling to divide that meristem up. And so you can do either or with shallots.
And I found that they are not quite as pungent in their flavor. And so if you're someone who doesn't care for garlic as much, I can't figure out why.
I didn't either,
shallots, or as a good friend of mine always says, shallots
yeah.
Yes, can be an alternative.
Yeah, and it's a little bit stronger than onion, but not as pungent as a garlic is. And so depending on, you know, your preferences, it's not hard to grow. It's kind of like growing. If you plant in the fall, it's like growing garlic. And if you plant in the spring, it's like growing onions. And if you've got some offsets of shallots, you know, this is the time to plant the sets. And if you're going to wait and buy some seed for shallots, you would plant those in the spring at the same time you would seed your onions and grow them exactly the same way as you would either garlic in the fall or onion in the spring. So it's another one that you might want to try. And they do have it has a very nice and different flavor profile. And there's a lot of recipes that I see all the time that have shallots in them. Certainly I think we could use a lot more of it. And, you know, if not that available, actually, in the local marketplace that's grown locally anyway. It's always been imported.
So in the next 60 seconds, what do you need to do with the shallots or the onions when you plant them? Do you treat them like a tulip bulb and give them a little bit of bone meal?
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt to do that. I mean, if we're planting garlic in the fall, you know, if you don't know what your nutrient analysis is and know what your soils are, you can supplement those types of things. Make sure that you get some phosphorus in there.
But don't plant them too deep?
Garlic should be planted 2 to 3 inches. Shallot bulbs should be planted 2 to 3 inches deep as well. And that gives them a nice location where they can overwinter. They won't freeze out. They also get the right temperature profile so that meristem can divide and you can get this multiple bulbed garlic or shallots in the next summer. And we would then harvest them again in late June or July if we planted in the fall. Or if you have shallots in the spring from seed, those would be maturing more like onions in September.
Okay, Dan, thank you very
Great.
Much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Coming up next after a brief break is an interview with Jack Green about the colors in Utah mountains. This is The Zesty Garden. I'm Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Jack Green. He served as a wilderness ranger with the Logan Ranger District of the U.S. Forest Service for 11 seasons, hiking the Naomi and Wellsville Wilderness. And he teaches others about the natural history and ecology of our valley and mountains and has many wildlife encounters to share. He currently supervises science student teachers at USU and volunteers mentoring student interns in the Student Sustainability Office. And we're going to talk about Utah's fall colors. And I wanted to talk to you specifically about a lecture that you recently gave. And the title of it had something to do with how Utah's colors are, you consider them better than the back east. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because normally I would think of when I've never been to the East Coast during the fall color season. And so I would think, wow, they have a ton of color there. Maybe it's just more trees because there aren't as many here. But what's your reasoning for why Utah's colors rival or are better than those in the East?
Yes. Well, actually, I spent my growing up years in Michigan and northern Wisconsin. So that's about as good as it gets back that way. And, of course, you have the New England states, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and so on. And they're gorgeous. There's no getting around it. And they have hardwood forests where the trees that really give the color are larger. So that, as far as a comparison between tree sizes and so on, of course, they win. But the vibrancy is the same here as it is there. Plus, here we have that wonderful mix of aspen in our mountains where you get the gold contrasting with the orange and the red and the pink and so on, along with a lot of conifers along the spruce fir and Douglas fir and so on. That mix, and also, of course, we have our mountains where we have cliffs. You have these steep slopes and so on. And as you're looking up or looking down, you're just seeing this. I've often heard it referred to as a Fruit Loop bowl of color. That's phenomenal. So I think given the relief that we have with our rugged mountain landscapes, the cliffs, the aspen, the mix of conifers and so on, it really, I think, gives you that ideal mix, kind of hung for the poet's eye, so to speak. Just very, very beautiful. And here, too, of course, you have a lot of water to go with it, where you have the lake reflections. And you have it back there, too. But here you have the mountains that add to that mix.
So it's not that the vibrancy is any better as far as actually if you took two leaves, one from mm-hmm. each area, and looked at them, you know, they'd be pretty close to the same. But you're saying it's that palette that surrounds that color that really sets them off more than the East.
I think so. And again, you know, we all have our own, I guess, appreciation and take on what's best and so on. But and then too, I think given our drier climate, lower humidity and so on, oftentimes we'll get these deep blue skies to go with it and very white fluffy clouds and so on. So you don't have the high humidity here, and I think that has something to do with it. Just these explosions of color. So the climatic differences, too, I think have something to do with that.
So why don't you explain what is happening to go from the green to all of those vibrant colors? What's happening in the leaf?
Sure. The reason that the plants do this, and these are the deciduous primarily, although we do have western larch, if you get up into the northwest, that is a conifer that turns this beautiful deep gold color and loses its needles through the winter. But for the most part, it's the deciduous broad-leaved, as we call it, leaved trees that do this. And the reason this happens, that's evolved this way, is because the winters, the colder the temperature is, the drier the atmosphere is. And also, of course, when the ground's frozen, a lot of the water that's normally available to the trees isn't available. So they're facing a real serious drought condition, very low humidity, very extremely dry air, and frozen ground. So to protect themselves from dehydrating to the point where it might kill the plant, these leaves have to go. So they go through a process where there's a blockage called an abscission layer that forms where the leaf attaches to the branch, and that gradually cuts off the transport of materials in and out of the leaf. So they will start to collect more sugars in the leaf, and that brings about a chemical change, which does two things. One, it dissolves the chlorophyll in the leaf, so that green disappears, and some of those hidden colors suddenly start showing up, especially some of the oranges, yellows, and browns, the tannins, carophylls, and xanthophylls, as they're called. And then there's a chemical process that actually produces a new substance called anthocyanin that gives us the blue and the purple colors primarily.
So some leaves already have them, they're just hidden, and others develop them?
Well, the anthocyanins are developed, the blues and the purples and such, whereas the reds, excuse me, let's throw the reds in there. Whereas the oranges and the yellows and the browns were already there. They were just masked behind the chlorophyll, which is, of course, on the surface to photosynthesize.
What trees tend to give the best colors?
Mm-hmm. Well, here again, we score big in that we have, if you go back east, without a doubt, the most gorgeous tree in the fall is the eastern sugar maple. We have the same here, only it's a subspecies, so it's a very close relative, genetically very similar. It doesn't grow nearly as large as the eastern sugar maple, called a big tooth, Rocky Mountain big tooth maple. So it has the same colors, the same chemistry going on, so you get the same vibrancy, it's just on a smaller scale. We have that. And then, of course, we have a lot of aspen as you go into the middle and higher elevations. And the golds that you get from the aspen is pretty incredible. So I think that mix of the big tooth maple and also Rocky Mountain maple, which is another species of maple that gives a gorgeous color. And I just came out of the canyon actually a few hours ago, Upper Smithfield Canyon, the Naomi Wilderness, and the mountain ash is another one we have here that just really takes off and just gorgeous colors. In fact, I saw a lot of colors just coming on
already
over the last few days.
Wow. Yeah,
in our mid to higher elevations.
So be looking for them already.
Already. Mm. And the berries and the rose hips, too, I might add. We have a great crop. And boy, those blues and reds, the mountain ash has this gorgeous orangish berry in large clusters. Beautiful things.
I'm thinking a couple of years ago when I had gone up to Tony Grove, and on the way down, we stopped at the overlook that you can see over into Logan Canyon. And here were all of, there was this broad palette of yellow, because I assumed most of them were aspens, and right in the middle was this orange-red rush of color that was right there. And I'm assuming they weren't aspens. It must have been a maple there. Can an aspen be red?
An aspen can. Actually, and you've probably heard this before, that aspens are clones. So you get a mass of aspen that are actually all genetically identical because they're same from the same root mass. They're just cloned stems coming out of that root mass. And some of them actually do have a pinkish, reddish color. Aspen can do that.
So that one I was looking at just happened to be separate from, it was a clone unto itself?
Not sure. You know, I'd have to go up and investigate. And we'd have to
do some
genomic studies. But
but it was interesting to look at just all of this yellow and then bloom right in the middle.
It could have been that there was a maple mixed in, because oftentimes you will have the maple mixed with the aspen to a degree. So.
Can you plant this Rocky Mountain big tooth maple in your own yard?
Oh, absolutely.
And so it'll grow down here, even though the pH up there is a little bit lower. And I know if you try to grow, I've been told anyway, that if you try to grow a sugar maple from back east here, it's not going to do so well. But this one I have wondered about.
Yes, these have adapted very well. In fact, if you go to Minden and the Wellsville town in the fall, called Maple Bench, that runs pretty much all along the eastern edge there of the Wellsville Mountains. Those vibrant colors, that's all maple, and they thrive. They do very well. I have one in my yard in Smithfield, and, well, I have two. I have the Big Tooth Maple and the Rocky Mountain Maple, and they both are thriving.
Now, of course, I grew up in Minden, so I always called them the Minden Mountains, and the cartographers just got it all wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, so being able to walk up, take hikes up there, I was just used to having that sort of color. Just absolutely breathtaking to do a hike up Deep Canyon, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
You take Third North in Minden and drive all the way up to the mouth of Deep Canyon and just park your car. You're right there at the tree line. It goes from fields to the maples, and then just walk up in there. It's absolutely gorgeous.
And I will mention, too, that in our canyon bottoms along the streams, we have box elder and cottonwood and willow and so on, and Radoja dogwood, and they give you a wonderful palette as well of varying shades of gold and yellow. And the red osier dogwood, of course, turns pink and purple, and just beautiful mix.
And I've seen those in yards. Yes. Box elders tend to have a bad name associated with them.
Bad rep,
yeah.
They do.
So why is that? Is it just because of the box elder bugs?
Well, and they're considered to be messy trees, okay? They produce, in a good year, they'll produce a lot of seed, and of course that falls to the ground, and then sometimes, depending on the precipitation and so on, they will lose leaves quite a bit through the latter part of the summer. So they're considered to be messy trees. And I personally love them for a number of reasons. They really attract birds and wonderful wildlife. And, of course, they're adapted to where we are.
They're extremely drought tolerant. I mean, I've seen them when you look at an old homestead and nothing else is growing around it. It's been abandoned for decades. Mm-hmm. You'll see a box elder tree that's still thriving.
Right. And I have to mention, too, that box elders are actually in the maple family. They're in the Acer family. And I and my students at Logan High have tapped them for the sap and made delicious syrup out of the box.
And it works.
Oh, it works.
Oh, wow.
Very well, yes. Yeah, you would enjoy it. Anyone would.
So I wanted to open this up and ask our listeners to email us zestygarden@gmail.com and tell us your favorite place to either hike or drive around the state for fall colors. And I'm going to mention that on the Zesty Garden in the following week. So again, it's zestygarden@gmail.com, and just send us a quick reference of where you like to go to see fall colors. So I mentioned Deep Canyon. Can you name a favorite?
I really can't.
Just find a canyon and go up.
Way too many. I would say that any of our canyons, and this is most years, I haven't found a bad year. Some are better than others, perhaps, but this is going to be a great year. Any of our canyons along here, either in the Wellsvilles or the Bear River Range, which is, of course, on our east side and that Logan Canyon slices through, they're all magnificent is all I can say. Being up Smithfield Canyon, living in Smithfield Canyon, Birch and so on, I spend a lot of time on those, and just glorious. But then I know many other canyons are as well. So you can't go wrong, really. I can't say there's really a favorite.
So if you wanted to put in one of these Rocky Mountain Big Tooth Maples, where would you find them? Do you have to worry about the rootstock they're on? Or sometimes you can't really find them. I guess it's knowing where to go, but where would you suggest?
Well, I would find a friend who has them, okay? If you have some friends in Minden or Wellsville who are up on the bench and they're growing and you're not in the forest, of course, you don't want to take them out of the forest. That's that's illegal. But on private land, if you get permission from the owners, you know, you can go. And I wouldn't take them if they're more than 3 feet in height, because that way you can get pretty much a good portion of the root mass, and they're probably going to do well.
And how would you grow them? Do they need any extra water, I guess, just to get established?
Yeah, like any anything you plant, really, especially a woody shrub or tree, the first few years you want to give it a good dose of water just to really get that root mass established and get the mycorrhiza, the fungus and bacteria that it needs to thrive, established. And that'll take, you know, usually a few years.
And can you grow them as a tree specimen, or are they more shrub?
Yeah, they'll grow into a tree. They'll get up, you know, they're a small tree. If they hit 30 feet, that's a big big-tooth maple, large big-tooth maple. So generally they're between 20 and 30 feet, depending on the site. I think I've seen them maybe up to 40 feet in a very favorable site. The largest I've seen and the best is in one of the Salt Lake canyons, where they will get up to 50 feet and probably a foot or more in diameter, which is unusual at breast height.
How long would you expect the big tooth maple to live?
Big tooth maple can go quite a distance. I'm guessing, you know, well over 100 years.
Oh, wow.
Maybe a few hundred years. One more I'll mention that's in that mix is the called the river birch or water birch. And they, too, are natives, and they, too, will give you a beautiful fall, deep gold color in the fall, and they're a gorgeous tree otherwise.
I also wanted to make our listeners aware of a website that can help you as you're planning where to go to see fall colors. It's called UtahFallColors.com. And one of the things they mentioned is that MSN.com rated the Upper Ogden Valley as one of the 10 most scenic areas for fall colors. And I could imagine doing a loop. So you would start in Logan, go up Logan Canyon, and then drive around the south end of Bear Lake, go over to Randolph and Woodruff, and then back up the Monte Cristo Highway through the Ogden Valley, and then back to Ogden, and then up the interstate back to Logan. That would be an awesome drive to take. And again, this website is UtahFallColors.com. Well, Jack, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Jack Green has served as a wilderness ranger with the Logan Ranger District of the U.S. Forest Service for 11 years, and he now supervises science student teachers at USU and volunteers mentoring student interns in the Student Sustainability Office at USU. Well, we have had a few comments from folks of where to drive or to hike to see fall colors. Glenna says that her favorite drive is Coldwater Lake. Both the drive and the hike are spectacular in the fall, and that would be at the foothills of the Wellsville Mountains between Mendon and Wellsville. My second favorite, she says, is a drive to Manaway, turn southbound, and just keep going. Elise from Hiram says, I agree with you about Deep Canyon. One of my favorites is Blacksmith Fork Canyon all the way up to Hardware Ranch. Maybe not as many colors as Logan Canyon, but a much shorter drive. Left-hand fork gets awesome color, and you don't have to go very far to see them. The favorite hillside she has, a favorite hillside, is the Quakies by the second dam just before Hardware Ranch. And the hike up to Coldwater, so there's a second one for Coldwater. It's gorgeous in the fall. Aren't we lucky? No matter where we go in Cache Valley, you can't miss seeing the colors. Danny in Hiram says there's a new one for him, Boss Canyon up Franklin Basin in and out of Idaho. Helps to have an ATV. And then Ken in Logan says, take the Franklin Basin Road over to Willow Flats, then come down Cub River and have dinner at the Deer Cliff Inn. The aspen are spectacular, and you can have dinner at an iconic restaurant. And also he says the canyon just south and a little west of Third Dam in Logan Canyon is another favorite. So if you have a favorite, you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. It's posted right there at the top. You can get your comments there or send an email to zestygarden@gmail.com.
Good morning, this is Nancy Williams, and I wanted to talk to you today about carrots and other sweet wonders, but mostly carrots. And I'll read to you a little bit from the book by Rebecca Rupp called How Carrots Won the Trojan War. And we'll start with a quote from Fran Lebowitz, who said, "Large naked raw carrots are acceptable as food only to those who lie in hutches eagerly awaiting Easter." I think a lot of us might feel that way. But Rebecca Rupp has some information about their background. And she says, Beatrix Potter's Peter Rabbit, who is certainly the most famous rabbit in literature, didn't eat carrots. No, really, he didn't. Once he wiggled under Mr. McGregor's garden fence, he gorged on lettuces, French beans, and radishes. And then, feeling sick, he went off in search of parsley. At that point, he rounded a cucumber frame, encountered the justifiably enraged Mr. McGregor, and spent most of the rest of his book running. That evening, still without a carrot in sight, his well-behaved siblings, Flopsy Mopsy and Cottontail, got blueberries and milk for supper, while the reprehensible Peter was put sternly to bed with a dose of chamomile tea. Rabbits will eat carrots, but frankly, carrots don't seem to be all that high on the rabbit food list. Their preferred vegetables are peas, beans, and beets. And if you grow any or all of these, the only way to keep rabbits from munching up the lot is to put a 2-foot fence around your garden. Alternatively, you can sprinkle the perimeter with dried blood or fox urine, or you can get a ferret. Not that these are guarantees. Rabbits are pushy, persistent, and tough. People, on the other hand, not only eat carrots, but apparently adore them. Each one of us consumes about 12 pounds of carrots a year. And that's up from a mere 4 annual pounds in 1975. And kids who turn up their noses at squash and spinach routinely list carrots among their vegetable favorites. Historically, foremost among American carrot fans was industrialist Henry Ford, whose passion for vegetables was perhaps second only to his fondness for the automobile. Ford was anti-milk. He said, quote, "The cow is the crudest machine in the world," and anti-meat. He promoted soybeans in lieu of beef and oatmeal crackers as a substitute for chicken. But he was devoted to the carrot, which he was convinced held the secret to longevity. At one point, he was the guest of honor at a 12-course all-carrot dinner, which began with carrot soup and continued through carrot mousse, carrot salad, pickled carrots, carrots au gratin, carrot loaf, and carrot ice cream, all accompanied by glass after glass of carrot juice. One story holds that Ford became interested in the painter Titian when his son Edsel donated a Titian painting to the Detroit Institute of Art. It wasn't the artist's work that interested him. It was the fact that Titian had reportedly lived to be 99. He wanted to know if Titian ate carrots. The first carrots, botanists believe, came from Afghanistan and were purple, Rupp continues, scrawny, highly branched and unpromising, these wine-colored roots belonged, like their plump cultivated descendants, to the Apiaceae family. Some 300 genera and 300 species of aromatic plants commonly known as umbellifers. As well as the crunchy carrot, the Apiaceae family included celery, parsnips, anise, caraway, chervil, cilantro, cumin, dill, fennel, lovage, parsley, and poison hemlock. This last, known in Ireland as devil's porridge, an infusion of which killed Socrates. The ancestral carrot, though, probably looked very much like Queen Anne's lace, which is the ubiquitous wild carrot of present-day fields and roadsides. The primitive purple, violet, red, and black carrots owed their color to anthocyanin, a pigment that dominated the carrot world until approximately the 16th century, when a pale yellow anthocyanin-less mutation appeared in Western Europe. It must have been an anthocyanin-laced purplish carrot that Agamemnon's soldiers legendarily munched, presumably quietly, inside of the Trojan horse, quote, to bind their bowels, unquote, and that Greeks on the home front used to concoct an aphrodisiacal potion. Like any vegetable even vaguely resembling a penis, the carrot was thought to be a passion promoter. Devious Roman soldiers boiled carrots in broth to release the sexual inhibitions of their female captives, and the emperor Caligula, who had a fun-loving streak, once fed the entire Roman Senate a feast of carrots in hopes of watching them run sexually amok. That's the most fun in this whole book. As well as beta-carotene, carrots are also high in minerals, notably potassium, calcium, and phosphorus. They also contain a lot of sugar, making all of us happy. Because of their lip-smacking sweetness, carrots historically have been used in desserts. The Irish, who doubtless found carrots a welcome relief from a relentless diet of potatoes, called them underground honey. One of my personal favorite things to do with carrots is to turn them into carrot soup. Here's our family's favorite recipe for ginger carrot soup, and it's simple enough I can read it to you, and I bet you can write it down. There's not that many ingredients. That's why I love it. Carrot ginger soup is my adaptation from a Food Network recipe, which was more complicated. I simplified it. Here's what you need. 2 tablespoons of sweet cream butter, 2 onions peeled and chopped, 6 cups of chicken broth, 2 pounds of carrots peeled and sliced, 2 tablespoons of grated fresh ginger, 2/3 of a cup of buttermilk, 1/3 of a cup of half and half, 1/2 a cup of fresh squeezed orange juice, salt and white pepper, sour cream, and parsley sprigs for garnish. Here is all you have to do. In a nice big 6-quart pan over medium heat, add the butter and the onions and cook those, stirring often until the onions are limp. Now add the broth, the carrots, and ginger. Now cover that pot and bring it to a boil. Reduce the heat and simmer until the carrots are tender. Now you remove from the heat and transfer it to a blender if you want to do it the hard way, or you can do what I do, which is to use an immersion blender right in the pot. You know, those are those little boat motor things. Don't fill the blender more than halfway if you have to take it to a bigger blender, and do it in batches if you're going to do it that way. Make sure that you are careful when you're blending hot liquids, as the mixture can spurt out of the blender, or it can spurt out of the pot if you're using an immersion blender, so just be careful. Pulse the blender to start it, and then puree the whole thing until it's smooth. Then put it all back in the pan. Add the buttermilk, half and half, and orange juice, and stir over high heat until it's hot. And then you can add the salt and pepper to taste, and then you just ladle this into bowls and garnish with a little dollop of sour cream and parsley sprigs. Bon appetit, carrot fans. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.